Bears Robert Crane, a Microsoft Office 365 MVP who knows practically everything there is about Office 365. He does stand-up events talking about Office 365. He writes about Office 365 on his blog site, and he does in-person training sessions and training videos about Office 365. There's also me, Mark Keane. I'm the voiceover guy and producer of this podcast. I'm also a Microsoft Azure technical specialist, PowerShell extraordinaire, and IT consultant, helping people move to the Microsoft cloud and consume it by helping them to make sense of it. This is a Need to Know podcast with Robert Crane and Mark Keane. It's all about the Microsoft cloud.
Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast. My name is Robert Crane, and I'm joined by Mark Keane. Mark, welcome.
How are you, Rob?
Not too bad. How are things going for you at the moment? Obviously, since our last podcast, been a little while, you've been up and about doing things, surely keeping busy, no doubt. So what's been happening?
Lots of changes, actually. I was an unemployed bum for a short time there. But in the process of changing jobs, I would probably say it's more of an upgrade, I would say, for my stage of my career. Moving to a role more technical, I guess, more so suited to what I was doing before, more aligned, I guess, too. So I started there probably a couple of weeks, about 10 days ago, I think, and things are going quite well so far. So that's pretty much it, just settling in. What about yourself?
Yeah, I've been out and about doing a little bit more travel, speaking to partners typically about Azure, running a couple of deep dive sessions on getting the Azure bug and getting started and trying to understand what it is. I think that the biggest limitation or the biggest challenge that most resellers typically find is understanding how to get started. Of course, you know, Azure is such a huge product when you look at it from the outside, so many options, so many different things that you could do. It's a case of where do you get started. So
virtual machines would be one of them, I think.
Yeah, backup's always the thing that I tend to point people towards to get them started, to make it easy. But again, I think if you're not into it, you haven't done it, some of the documentation probably, you know, it can be a bit daunting. You know, where do you start? It does require a little bit of investment in time, but I think backups, obviously virtual machines as well. But even so, you know, the big question, you can run up a single virtual machine, but then, you know, how do I connect it to a network? How do I create a domain controller? And best practices around that. So, again, there is an investment in time in learning and doing that. And if you're obviously time poor, perhaps you don't have, you know, the resources to do that. But hopefully I've been able to illustrate to people that it's not that difficult. The easy way to start, I think, is obviously into backup and backup your own machines and then, you know, backup customers and then grow up from there. But I think the important thing is obviously to get started.
Yeah, I would have thought it would have been virtual machines, because the reason why I say that is because, I don't know if I've mentioned this to you before, but it's 80% of Azure users in APAC use IaaS and virtual machines. So just to clarify that, what somebody was saying, the reason why it is so high, 80%, is the fact that it's APAC. And if you take Australia out of the equation and just leave it with the Asian countries, because of the different languages that they speak, a lot of the SaaS providers these days are US-based, that they don't offer the languages for the Asian countries, which basically leaves them to set up their own environments in place of the SaaS in IaaS. And so that's what somebody is saying, the reason why IaaS and virtual machines are so high in APAC. Although the other part of that I'm thinking is because everybody knows what a virtual machine is. You just jump onto the Azure portal and set up a virtual machine, and there it is. And it's through a GUI, your remote desktop to it. So that's, I guess, because people can relate to a virtual machine. Is that what you're finding, Rob, with your events that you're doing?
No, the reality is most people obviously can create virtual machines, and they, you know, it's fairly easy, like you said, to spin it up. But it's about the purpose. It's like, you know, okay, I spun up a virtual machine, what should I do? I think the advice I give most people is you need to have a problem that you need
a
to
plan.
Enter. Well, you need to have, for example, you know, my entry into Azure was based on my need to migrate SharePoint databases or SharePoint sites into Office 365, and that requires basically swinging the database between different versions of SharePoint. So if you've got 2003, you need to migrate it to 2007, then 2010, then 2013, and off to Office 365. Now, used to run all of that environment, the migration environment, in a single laptop, and that would struggle. Now, then I decided to, well, okay, how can I do this in Azure? And that was sort of the entry that I had. I had a problem that I need to solve, and I used Azure to do it. I think that a lot of people coming, generally, we need to learn Azure, we need to do this, but again, that's a bit unfocused. Where do I start? I think if you've got a particular problem that you're looking to solve, it's much better and much easier, because then you can start applying particular items from Azure to that. And obviously, it's not going to be resolved or solved immediately, but I think you need to come with a bit of a plan.
Yeah, so for me, I mean, that's a good use case. What I do for my startup is every Sunday, I have a group of virtual machines which are mostly shut down for most of the time, and they're deprovisioned because I'm not sort of interested in the external IP address and things like that. Also, too, there's the permanent billing in Azure. So what I do is every Sunday is I just open up PowerShell or the GUI, whichever, select all the virtual machines, fire them all up. There's 12 of them in total. They all power up. Come back about 20 minutes later once they're up. I can then remote desktop to the same DNS name. So that doesn't change. That remains the same. But because it's a low TTL, they come up with a new IP address. I can still connect to them fairly instantly afterwards. I can do what I need to do. I run processes on them. And once the processes are finished, I then shut them down. So they're only up for about two hours at the most. I'm only charged for 2 hours for those virtual machines. So that's another scenario. It's the permanent billing, which is a good selling point of Azure, Rob, because it's different to all the other players in the market, which I think are per hour.
Well, I think, again, there's certainly a lot of options now. I think that, you know, especially in the SMB style space, is that most resellers are still obviously running around doing keeping the on-prem servers running and all that, but they do know that they need to get into the Office 365, but also into the Azure stuff. And again, you know, if you haven't kept up with it, if you haven't been doing it as we have, I suppose, you know, drip feeding yourself and keeping up to date, then when you jump into it, it's very daunting. There's so many things. And now you've got, for example, in Azure, you've got, you know, service manager versus resource manager, and some things still in service manager, not in resource manager. That can be very confusing to get the right answer. So I think, you know, that's where a lot of it is based. But the reality is, it's not getting any easier. There's more and more stuff coming out. There's more and more changes happening. And the longer you wait, the more difficult it is to keep up to speed. So I think that's sort of the message. Look, you need to start. You don't have to basically boil the ocean immediately, but you certainly need to get in there and start working with it.
So what about the audience themselves, Rob, with the technical abilities? What did you find?
Well, I think, again, you know, as with any audience, any general thing, is you find a variation of people. So people who, you know, have done large environments, small environments, who are comfortable, you know, working in within set parameters. And again, you've got other people who have gone into deeper dive areas. So it varies, but I think the advantage is that, like I said, something like Azure gives them an additional tool set. It doesn't lock them in. It doesn't say that the cloud's the only way, or that you have to do a whole migration over the weekend into Azure or whatever. But I think even if you look beyond the Azure into things like Amazon and Google, that, you know, these tools are basically becoming powerful enough to solve just about any sort of problem. And I think that's the important thing it brings to the table. It means that you know they're able to solve problems for their customers much easier, potentially, or with far more resources than they ever used to be. And I think that the important thing, obviously, is to make sure that they're taking advantage of that, which, again, is not sort of going to happen on its own. You certainly do need to get in there and start learning the product, using the product. And people like Microsoft, luckily, give us things like Action Pack and a number of free tools to get involved in that. So that's the other side of the coin. I suppose that's the limitation I find also, is many people aren't aware of the free resources that Microsoft does provide them as a partner.
Yeah, look, you and I, we're both in cloud, and I guess, without being too narrow-minded, I do understand the both sides of the fence, the on-prem and the cloud. Look, I would say, like, to the next person, I would be the first person to put my hand up and say, hey, put everything in the cloud as much as you can. Just pump it full of stuff. But in saying that, I mean, the leg up that on-prem has at the moment with the private clouds is the fact with a virtual machine, they can make that highly available. I was having a conversation with some people last week. The comparison between private cloud and, say, public cloud, Azure, AWS, or anybody else, there's no SLA on a single virtual machine. And in saying that, a lot of people I'm talking to do have production workloads on single virtual machines, whereas it could go down at any time when Microsoft patched the host. Now, if you obviously remember that, Rob, where virtual machines do get patched from time to time, the host and the virtual machine can go down from time to time. Now, Microsoft don't do live migrations of virtual machines. There's no SLA on a single virtual machine yet. So the private cloud can differ because they offer that flexibility and the functionality to live migrate their virtual machine. So there's essentially no downtime when they're patching those hosts. So that's one big advantage still with on-prem as the cloud more so matures. But then in saying that, it's a different way of using the cloud. So you're saying before, Rob, like people can use it to do backups, to get in there first. I'm saying virtual machines. But then the other part of it is the level above that, which is the platform as a service, which is like SQL, for example, which is on the platform, and that does offer a high SLA. And so depending on what you use and how it relates back to on-prem, do you know what I'm saying?
Well, look, I think at the end of the day, it gives people more flexibility. I think it's a matter of understanding the tool sets available. I think that a couple of big changes are, firstly, that it's now much broader than one person can be across. So we've, you know, if you've got on-prem, you've got your Windows Server, your AD, but now you've also now got a significant amount of resources available to you in the cloud, understanding those. So in the smaller space, with a smaller provider, you're not going to have necessarily the bandwidth to be across all these. So I think a lot of that now requires leaning on a partner, leaning on someone who knows these products that you can call on to assist you. And I think building those relationships is a key thing, especially the smaller that you are. And that's a big change for a lot of providers who have typically approach their business as a lone gun. You know, I get paid for being better than the next guy and knowing everything. I think, unfortunately, it's just not possible these days. You have to rely on others. We're also seeing additional opportunities, like one of the messages that I get across is that, you know, like I said, Microsoft's very big into the Linux side of things, the open source now. It's growing very, very fast. 30% of Azure machines are running Linux. So, again, here's another opportunity, obviously, to get into that if you already are happy and familiar with Linux. But the other side, if you aren't, is you certainly need to find someone who can offer that. But when it comes to revenue opportunities, obviously now you can support, manage, provision, do all sorts of things around Linux as well. So at the end of the day, there's lots and lots of opportunity, but I think it's a matter of being focused. I mean, we can all get very distracted by technology and trying to do everything all the time. And part of the discipline of running a good business, I think, these days is to obviously focus on what you're good at and outsource or partner with others who can do the things that you can't.
All right, news this week. Let's get into it. I've got a few things to cover off, and I'm sure you do too, Rob, as well. So I've got some news sort of written up. I've stuck it on my blog site too, so you can have a look at that. We'll put the link in the show notes. But I guess the biggest news that's come out since we had our last podcast is SQL Server 2016. Now, you might be asking yourself, all right, well, how does SQL Server 2016 relate to the cloud? Well, I'll tell you how it does, is because Microsoft have been running it in Azure for quite some time in the lead up to the general availability of the product. Microsoft is touting SQL Server 2016 as one of the biggest product releases in the history of any product release, or it's a wrap, that what some people are saying as well. Like, it's definitely, they've done their homework, they've put a lot of work into it. So it's got the Stretch database. Rob, do you know the Stretch database? You can sort of, now they're having one database that's stretched across on-prem in the cloud, so it automatically moves old data up in Azure, for example. But the fact that you can sort of query that as well across the two, so you can save on, say, storage costs as well on-prem. They've introduced, like, JSON support, so you can interact with all various applications in this world of today. They've done a major revamp and a makeover of SQL reporting services, introduced HTML5 and all the good stuff, mobile reports and Power BI, all everything that's come out, because they haven't actually upgraded reporting services since 2010. So that's a nice welcome change. Also, column store indexes. Now, this is interesting because column store indexes is essentially in-memory tables. So rather than having it on your disk, it's in memory. So apparently it's 80% less disk space is used, they reckon. Queries running up to 2 times faster on top of the 10 times query performance gains. That's phenomenal. That's amazing. So not only that, they've got a new like paradigm where all joins, aggregations and machine learning are performed in the database itself without moving data out. So obviously that's going to be faster and also more secure. Also too, the features of SQL Server 2016 have been running and stress tested in Azure. Over 1.7 million Azure SQL databases, which basically means that it's bumped up the compatibility version of Azure SQL, which is on the platform, to 130, which is essentially SQL Server 2016. So starting mid-June, it's June now, it's the start of June, so starting mid-June, Azure SQL databases in Azure will have a default compatibility level of 130, which will be SQL Server 2016 under the covers for all newly created databases. So if you want to get started with SQL Server 2016, there's a free version called SQL Server 2016 Developer, which gives you all the features that you need to work with. It's available to Visual Studio and MSDN subscribers. There's also a free ebook available online as well, which you can download, which I'll put the link's on the blog site, and we'll put the link to the blog article in the show notes as well.
Cool. Well, like I said, I mean, I think the obviously we're looking at a a very different Microsoft from a few years ago. We've got stuff running on Linux. We've got things obviously coming out at a much quicker rate now. Obviously, things like SQL Server are very, very key to the Microsoft environment, both on-prem and in the cloud. And there's big advantage, obviously, being able to work with those tools, use those products, and potentially develop against them as well. But the trend, obviously, is as you mentioned, is to platform as a service, which removes all that worry about running virtual machines, load balancing, patching, all that sort of stuff. You just worry about your data. So, but that does require a bit of a shift, obviously, in the development so that it will support the features of the platform as a service. And I think that's, again, part of the challenge when it comes to doing migrations. In a perfect world, yes, everything would go to platform as a service, but at the end of the day, we're seeing that you probably need to go to a VM initially. So, again, lots of options, but it's great that Microsoft is having this available and providing resellers with this ability. So, yeah, this is fantastic, the stuff. And, again, it sort of changes the Microsoft from the old world where now we've got things like, SQL available on Linux. So, again, plenty of great options there. That's coming
soon. Very soon.
Exactly. Exactly right. And I think, and again, it's a matter of you can either look at it as a glass half full sort of thing where it's, they're taking my business away. But it's just a natural change, I think, in IT. So, again, there's lots more opportunities. But I think, again, as I said before, the secret is to focus on something and go with that. And again, now you've got more opportunities, SQL, you've got SQL on Linux, you've got all sorts of things. So, plenty of options there. What other news have you got for us?
Alrighty, PHP. So, if you don't know what PHP is, I can quickly explain it. PHP is like a language as such for web websites. PHP, normally if you're running it on IIS, you need to install the PHP part of it, which will enable IIS to read PHP and drive that through the engine. So PHP running in Azure version 5.4 is no longer supported as of October 2016 in Azure because they've announced the PHP group that they announced on September 3 last year They're going to remove it out of the support because they've been upgrading the version numbers. So with this PHP version 7, they've jumped up, is now generally available in Azure as well. Excuse me. Since May 2016, so support for PHP version 7 also introduces a new architecture as well, 64-bit, which hasn't been around before, so that's going to be a nice welcome change. If you want to stay based on compatibility on version 5.4 for PHP, you can actually run your own, bring your own runtime into Azure if you like. There is an area of Azure called Handler Mappings you're probably familiar with. It's similar to the IIS world where you'd, you'd essentially point the PHP to the INI file for the relevant version 5.4 PHP. So you can actually do that, but basically the support is ending for that. So
yeah, look, I think there's there's so much here. I think the question is obviously how do you keep up to date and keep on top of all this sort of stuff is what people are asking. And again, it's like I think you've got to focus and you can't be across everything. And hopefully this podcast can provide some sort of summary of all this, which is what we're aiming to do. But again, it's good to see all this stuff changing, improving, but it's very daunting, as we've said, that the sheer volume of stuff that's being available and changing can make life very challenging for someone. But again, like I said, if you're in that sort of space, that's available to you.
You just make sure you test your websites before changing stuff across.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that we've got this flexibility. I think that one of the biggest limitations that I do hear out of there, one of the biggest objections, obviously, is bandwidth. So again, we're still going to have those sort of issues, but there are many different ways to skin a cat here. So again, you can use a combination, a hybrid. You could move it into virtual machine and do an RDS session. There's lots and lots of options here. And I think that's the main thing that we're basically trying to get across. And I don't see the rate of change decreasing at all. So again, it's going to be a very, very, very busy world for most of us, I think.
So the other thing that popped up as well is BYOL. There's a nice little acronym for you, Rob. What does that stand for? Do you know?
Bring your own something, by the sound of it.
License. Bring your own license. So Microsoft's all about acronyms. They're basically saying that if you're an EA customer, have an enterprise agreement with Microsoft, you can bring your SQL Server licenses now to Azure VMs. It essentially means that out of the marketplace of images that Azure have, so when you go and deploy, say, SQL not on the platform, say an IaaS, which is using a virtual machine, rather than deploying a Windows virtual machine and installing SQL and stuff like that and putting a license on, you can go through the motions of deploying like a already created image from the Microsoft's gallery, which has Windows and SQL already installed to save you that work. It'll have BYOL in brackets at the end of it, which basically means that when you spin up that virtual machine, it'll have SQL running on it. However, you're only charged for compute costs only. You're not charged for the SQL part of it, the licensing in your Azure billing. Okay, if that makes sense. So you can spin up the virtual machine, get charged for the compute, but you have to have that license yourself for SQL. So I think that's a nice little change because some people do still run their SQL workloads in Azure on IaaS, sorry, in IaaS, I should say, in the virtual machines because it is set up to run across multiple VMs for protection against the any downtime and to achieve the SLA and the high availability. Also to Microsoft, their documentation service is getting a massive overhaul. TechNet and MSDN, do you remember those, Rob? Well, they're still around.
So they do. I think I reuse those basically every day these days.
Yes. They're about 15 years old, would you believe? And I remember too, with your mobile phones, you're going to a TechNet article and the article doesn't properly fit on the screen. Some of it goes off the right hand side and you can't sort of like make it smaller because it's just the way the website, the engine is displaying it. So I think this is a good change. All the new documentation is going to be put onto their docs service. So if you have a look at docs.microsoft.com, it's currently in preview at the moment. They're putting all the documentation on there in the first instance for EMS, the Enterprise Mobility Suite. So that's all up there now. But it's good because it introduces better readability. The read time is reduced. Content and site navigation is improved. Shortened article length. It's a responsive design, which basically means if you read it on a big screen and then change the size onto a small screen like a mobile phone, it's going to fit beautifully on whichever screen you look at, looking at it on. It's got community contribution. So the back end, Rob, is GitHub. So if you go on, similar to the Azure documentation service, if you jump onto the end of these pages, you can click on the button that says edit, which takes you to a GitHub page, which has got markdown language on it, and you can actually put edits and changes on there if you like. So you can actually provide feedback back to the team. Social sharing and friendly URLs and also website theming. So yeah, that's a nice change. It's currently in preview, so they're going to be putting more of their documentation onto that service moving forward.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing to remember with docs.com is it's a free service. Anybody can sign up to it and upload their own documents. Works well with traditional Microsoft Word, Excel, PowerPoint. I have a number of docs up there, a lot of presentations that when I finished, I put them up there. So docs.com/CIAOps. But anybody can use it, put their own documents up there. You can get analytics. You can get a share link. You can share it on social media. I think it's a pretty good platform, easy to embed the items into other locations as well. So it makes sense for Microsoft to move that. The thing you'll notice about TechNet articles generally these days is there's not a lot of diagrams because obviously with the technology changing so rapidly, doing screenshots and that gets out of date very quickly. But certainly it makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, again, a lot of the Azure stuff also is going into common repositories like GitHub. So that's sort of the platform we're seeing moving forward. Makes a lot of sense, makes it easy to edit, update, and work with multiple parties.
Yeah, it's interesting the way they do that, putting the back end onto GitHub. So obviously that's would need to be highly available, speaking of things being highly available. The other thing as well that's come out is the ability to switch Azure subscriptions, which hasn't been around before. Now, this is a nice welcome change. So it just means Azure customers can now switch their pay-as-you-go default subscriptions to another offer via the Azure Account Center. So you'd obviously have to be an account administrator to do this. Microsoft will continue to add more options based on demand. Currently, pay-as-you-go subscriptions can be switched to one of the following. 12-month commitment, a prepaid offer with a discount on Azure services. Now, that was announced, I think, last year, this 12-month commitment. Now, it's offering 5% discount on offerings on Azure services. You do have to have a minimum purchase of $7,500, and it's like the EA, so if you don't use it, you lose it. Unused balance at the end of the 12-month term will be forfeited. And any of the monthly Azure credit offers for Visual Studio subscribers as well, you can switch over to as well. So if you want more information about the switching offer, and they're going to be adding more flexibility around this too, so you can sort of, you're free to move around sort of whichever and however you want to go. There's a link in there as well on the site.
Yeah, so again, there's a significant amount of news obviously coming. I think one of the challenges, obviously, again, with a lot of these cloud-based products is licensing. I mean, how do you license it? I mean, there's typically, you know, a couple of models. There's the credit card, direct purchase. There's also CSP. There's the traditional open model. And, you know, at some stage it works well for people, but 9 times out of 10 there's probably going to need to be a switch at some point. So the flexibility, and Office 365 for example allows you to mix and match licenses, license types for different customers, and I think that Azure is moving towards that sort of flexibility. And generally it's a consumption thing, but for example remote app is a flat rate per month when it kicks off. So there are those variables, and there are those complexities, and can make things again a little bit more daunting to get your head around. But this flexibility, I think, is coming, and Microsoft does recognize that. So we should see more of those options, I think, which is great, which is going to, again, encourage more and more people to consume the services.
So the last one I've got here is talking about subscriptions. Test Drive Azure for nothing, for free. So they do have a free trial, Azure does, but that's requiring you to sign up with a credit card. You're not billed at that time and stuff like that. But this feature here is quite nice. I tried it out the other day. You can actually log into or use this feature and spin up proper workloads without even signing up, without even saying here you are, completely anonymous. So this is available now in the Azure Marketplace. It's called Test Drive. Without an Azure subscription, you can experience, like, say, Trend Micro's deep security running on Azure. So you can do all these things. There's a few partners that are participating, and I think the list is going to grow as we move forward. So players like Trend Micro, NetApp, and Yellowfin are participating at the moment. There's a whole list of them in there. But I think this is good because it just means that within seconds, you can sort of jump onto Azure if you don't have a subscription without having to put any details in there and test things out and make sure that they do what you're thinking they're going to do prior to even, say, setting up a trial and then moving that step further.
So how long do those environments typically remain for?
Don't ask me questions like that.
Damn, oh. So they're probably a 30-day trial or something.
Possibly,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to see. But again, it just takes that complexity out of, you know, having to get an account and sign up. And then, so if you just want a quick preview, I think obviously they're very good. I think that's a very good idea. And getting the benefits out of that sort of thing, I think, is going to make the product more accessible, and a lot more people probably going to take it up. So I think that's a really handy thing.
Yeah, so that's about it on my side, Rob. Actually, yeah, 30 days is the answer to that question. It's a trial of 30 days.
Okay, there you go. So I think that, like I said, you know, it's going to be the fairly standard stuff and just remove some of that complexity. And thanks to the wonders of automation and scripting and all that sort of stuff, it's basically able to spin those up pretty quickly and get those going. And that's, I think, another key example here of a lot of this cloud-based stuff now is the automation power of, as you all know, you know, things around PowerShell and JSON, certainly something that people need to get into if they're looking to work with this sort of infrastructure. Again, the ability to deploy it quickly and easily and consistently, and that's the way to do it, is obviously with scripts.
Gotta love PowerShell.
True, and I think, unfortunately, again, I think a lot of it is for people who aren't particularly into programming. It can be, again, a bit of a daunting thing to get started. I think that PowerShell 5 obviously makes life a lot easier than it ever used to. But again, you know, just getting the environment right. Where, how do you get started? How do you click this in? What commands? I think, again, it's generally when you look for the information about a PowerShell, you end up generally in the weeds pretty quickly, and it's like, okay, where do I actually start? What do I actually start? The first couple of commands that I need to run. I think that in a lot of cases,
I can help you with that.
I can help you with that.
Windows updates is a good place to start. So
yeah, I saw that post of yours.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Like, you can run with PowerShell 5 now, which is part of Windows 10. You can do what's called install module, and that goes out to the PowerShell gallery and installs modules. So back in the day, before Windows 10, before PowerShell 5, it was a bit painful, wasn't it, Rob? You had to get a module,
the modules in place,
install it, import module, had to direct it to the right location and the right file. It was a little bit painful, but now it's all over the web. So once you install the module of the Windows Update feature, you can then go ahead and do, like, essentially a Windows Update, like you would normally. So you can automate that process, see all the Windows updates coming, and you get more flexibility, and it's much, much faster. You can see it on the screen. In my opinion, there's more control.
Yeah, well, it's surprising how few commands you need to actually get it up and running. So obviously you did a blog post on that, which we'll refer people to, but that's another, you know, key feature here is this, how much quicker and easier and in some cases better life is just using the PowerShell side, because that's what Microsoft obviously wants the IT pro to use when it comes to managing services like on-prem Office 365 and Azure. I think that's the key, another key skill that everybody's going to need to have moving forward, which means a bit of programming. But I think, again, the hardest thing obviously is, you know, where do I start? Where do I get the basics? How do I connect this or do this? And I think that's where a lot of people do struggle. And then I suppose, where's good information around, you know, decent PowerShell scripts, because I tell people the only thing you need really to be a PowerShell expert is two keys, Control-C and Control-V, so just copy and paste everything you find and build your own scripts from there.
So what about Office 365? We've talked about Azure for enough, I think, so far, because I'm all newsed out at the moment. So what have you got on the Office 365 thing side?
Well, I think there's Office 365 obviously is a continuing, you know, always doing stuff in the background. There hasn't been a huge amount of, I suppose, earth-shattering news. They keep moving on. Obviously, Microsoft's moving towards the end of the financial year as it rounds up and begins looking towards the new year. But some changes that came this month were the ability to have basically document conversations in documents. So if you have got a Word document open, you can open a conversation panel.
Is that collaboration?
Yeah, that's the collaboration one they're talking about. So you can basically have a Skype-style conversation in a little, I suppose, table or window on the side of the document. So, again, what we find is that many, many people, obviously, the way that they collaborate, in inverted commas, is they edit a document, then they attach it and send it to six people, and those six people come back with changes, and then they've got to merge them all together and ask one question and then send it out again, and again it all becomes a little bit complicated and difficult to manage. So I think that
will that work with all the Office products, Word, Excel, yeah, PowerPoint, everything? Because before I think one of them didn't work. I think PowerPoint or Excel. I think it was Excel.
Yeah, I think they've announced that they're going to do that. Obviously, you need the current version of Office to do this sort of mm-hmm. thing. So that's certainly being rolled into all the updates that are coming out. So again, I think that if you look at Office 365, you see that you know, there are new features, there are new products coming, but you're seeing this constant refinement in the background. So
yeah,
Some of the other things that we've seen start rolling out is obviously Microsoft announced last month basically a new experience around SharePoint. That is beginning to make its way into our tenant. So my tenant is on first release. That means it gets early updates to Office 365, and we began to see the change of team site.
I saw something about that, something about who moved my cheese, somebody on Twitter. But what's the changes? I think is it changed to the UI, or what's happening there?
Well, I think for most people, that SharePoint's obviously been around since before, you know, the year 2000, so it's a fairly mature product, but typically it was aimed at the enterprise and people who understood document management, and Microsoft's had a number of different iterations in the interface, the way it appears. The most recent one made it look very much like Office with the ribbon menu across the top. But as more and more people come on board with SharePoint who have never used SharePoint before, they're simply wanting to use it for you know, basic tasks like, you know, uploading documents and creating a basic list and maybe just putting some pictures and viewing it like an intranet or a portal. Now, SharePoint's very good, but still very technical product to do that. So what Microsoft has done basically is it's putting a new look and feel over the top of SharePoint. It's bringing some things that were perhaps neglected to more towards the front, and it's making it easier for people to create, you know, modern responsive websites based on SharePoint. So the technology that was always there, the document management, the check-in, check-out, the version control is still there, but Microsoft is changing the look and feel and make it easier for users to work with. So if you're familiar with OneDrive Consumer or OneDrive for Business, the changes we've seen in that interface are what we're going to start seeing happening with SharePoint. Now, this is certainly a great thing, I think, and it makes SharePoint more relevant. It makes it more up to date. It makes it, like I said, prettier, I suppose, is the way to do it, which is one of the common criticisms that SharePoint undergoes. But obviously, this is a big change because you're changing something that is the core of the way that people store files and access.
People don't like change.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that'll be very interesting to judge. I think the changes are very good because they actually simplify things. They reduce the complexity on the screen. They make things, you know, basically much easier to see, view. I think that's going to be positive. But at the underlying core here, you're changing the way document libraries appear. You change the way that they work. And that, for a lot of people who are SharePoint people, can be a very big challenge. But I think at the end of the day, we're seeing this paradigm shift where you're having so many users who have never used Microsoft technologies like SharePoint directly every day are now doing so in Office 365, and that's where the product has to be built, maintained, and move forward based on those users, because they are now becoming the majority. So
yep.
I think the changes are good, but they are, like you said, going to mean some challenges for people when they see the interface start changing. So for most people, they won't probably see this until September, October, or towards the end of the year. But if you want to get on and have a look, and recommend it for obviously resellers so they're aware of these changes, make sure that your tenant is on first release, which means you get the Office 365 changes before anybody else.
People don't like change. However, if you change it fast enough... No, hang on. What's the old saying? People don't like change, but if once you change it, it becomes a new norm.
Yeah, and I think...
So they get in other words, they get used to it. They whinge for a little bit, and they get used to it, and they move on.
I think that the problem is that, you know, you've got to see the benefit of the change, the improvement, and that's what probably... Yeah. Some people struggle with, because, as you said, they're very used to doing things in the same old way. One of the struggles, I suppose, that's very common in the world that I work in is, you know, everybody wants a map drive. Okay, I want to move it to SharePoint Online, but I still want my map drive. I want to access everything to the map drive.
Mm.
And part of it is moving on from that, because that is a limiting factor. You can't use metadata. You don't get automation. You can certainly use SharePoint to do that, but doing things the old way generally does limit the productivity. So part of it is, to get the benefit of the latest technology, you do have to invest in learning it, or you know, getting up to speed with it, but the benefits can be quite significant. So I think, again, it's another indication of how commoditized or how common a utility that IT has become, is that, you know, it's now so pervasive that, again, you know, people become very set in their ways, don't want to change it. They still want to stay on, you know, Windows 7 or whatever, because they don't see the benefits of Windows 10. We understand that, but when you look at the benefits, you look at the rapid rate of change, and as we know, the longer you sit on a product or sit on a version, the more difficult it becomes to support and upgrade and manage. So,
hey, I'll tell you a story.
Yep.
I was on the train yesterday coming home from work. I was surprised. There was this guy in front of me on the seat, had a laptop, a thick laptop, a Lenovo one, like it would have been at least probably 4 years old. He turned it on. It had Windows 7 on it.
No, they're quite common, because I think a lot, there is a, you know, a perception out there that obviously Windows 7 is well tested and it works and all that sort of stuff. And I think that, again, the change can be difficult for a lot of people. And I also think that, unfortunately, a lot of people believe the clickbait they see on the internet, you know, all these issues. Again, people that have, you know, problems with upgrading Windows 10 obviously make a lot of noise, and it gets a lot of press because it, you know, generates revenue and via advertising and stuff like that. So, I can understand it, but the difference between Windows 7 and Windows 10 is significant. It's huge.
But the thing is, right, when I looked close, well, I wasn't stalking him, I wasn't spying on him, but I could see the yellow stuff, and I could sort of, when he started it up, he had Symantec written on the wallpaper. So obviously, they're a massive company, but they're probably, like any other company, haven't upgraded their fleet yet from, say, Windows 7 up to say Windows 10 or anything else.
A big change for some enterprises.
Yes.
And lots and lots of machines, and they've got, you know, custom builds, and they've got, it is complicated, right? But again, the reality is, in the world we live in, it's all about constant change. You've got to be comfortable with that in every way, shape and form, and that can be frustrating, don't get me wrong, but you know, that's just the world we live in, and that's what we sort of need to adjust to.
It's like 7-Eleven. I was there the other day, walked in, bought something, and then I noticed on his computer with Windows XP at this time.
Yeah, well, again, I think part of it is we sort of don't appreciate that IT's growing up, and it's now become so pervasive that obviously it's everywhere. And again, doing upgrades is not a case of just automatically applying it to every machine. There are some significant challenges doing it, and changes to do it. And I think that there is an opportunity and a threat there. Obviously, you know, make sure that you're up to date and do all this sort of stuff. But the big thing is once you start getting back to XP, where Microsoft doesn't support it more, all that sort of stuff, it becomes a real If you do get problems, then fixing it becomes a major leap. So I think it's better generally to try and keep up to date with small increments rather than hanging off and trying to do that one big leap up to the old version to the new version. And again, you look at products like Azure and Office 365, the world that we live in is now about basically monthly changes that are rolling out constantly. And a lot of the conversations I've had with other technical people is that, you know, it's too much, it's too, you know, we can't deal with it, we can't keep up with it. You know, there are so many changes happening so
whinge,
fast.
Whinge, whinge.
But part of it also, you've got to look at it and understand, it's not necessarily a whinge, it's the fact that for Microsoft to remain competitive against people like AWS and Google, it needs to have these constant changes rolling out because they're developing at the same rate. So it's simply the world that we live in. And again, another example is look at the difference between cars of, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. The stuff that you get included now, the technology that's inside them is absolutely amazing. And the price generally, you know, keeps going down for the features that you get. And it's just a factor of the world that we live in. And I think, as I said initially, the thing that you need to do is focus. You can't do it all. You can't be across all these changes. Pick, you know, something that you want to focus on and make sure that you keep up to date with that. The other stuff, you know, you've got to obviously listen to stuff like this podcast, talk to Mark or whatever, and keep up to date with people that you know. But you just can't be across all this stuff. It's just too difficult and there are too many sources.
Yeah, so like those people you're talking about, the people that are sort of making their complaints heard or their feedback heard or their comments heard about the cloud, look, the benefit is, As I said before, when I mentioned SQL Server, is the fact that Microsoft is stress testing, is using these new products in public cloud, in the data center, before it gets released to on-prem. So yeah, they're still pushing out stuff on-prem, like the new SharePoint Server, which came out a little while ago, SQL Server that was GA'd just a couple of days ago, but it's all been used in the public cloud. And if we didn't have the public cloud there, then that wouldn't have been like an option to do that. So it works out better for these people who are still got their on-prem stuff.
Well, I think the good thing that Microsoft brings to the equation is that you can still do, you know, on-premises. You've still got that flexibility. Again, their message was a few years ago, obviously, the cloud or nothing, but that has changed with the regime change as well, and they appreciate that, you know, some people will maintain on-prem, some people will maintain a hybrid, and some people, you know, want the opportunity to go totally cloud. I think they're one of the few providers that will give you that ability quickly and easily, and I think that's what a lot of people don't appreciate. It's, you know, gives you that flexibility, but again, the key thing is I think you do need to have some knowledge around all the offerings that are available if you don't use them, because the stuff that's brought out to the cloud is just brought out so much quicker, so much faster, and generally so much more powerful that, you know, more and more customers look, I don't care what it is, I just want to use the technology, and generally the cloud stuff is going to give you all those facilities so much quicker and easier and cheaper generally, and people need to be, you know, obviously aware of that. And again, that if you go to the cloud, generally that will remove the need to update yourself. It will simply happen for you in the background, which is probably a lot of benefit and why it appeals to a lot of people.
Actually, speaking of cheap and stuff like that, here's something interesting for you. Speaking to somebody the other day about Azure backups, I know you were sort of talking to your people about in the events about Azure backups and stuff. Now, when I mentioned to him about cost of storage in Azure, he said, well, versus the cost of tape, because the other option is backup to tape, then you've got to keep all these tapes and fork out all this money. He reckons that backing up to Azure, even though it does have a high cost to it, works out cheaper, much, much cheaper.
Well, I think there are a lot of factors. Obviously, there's electricity, there's support, there's you know, there's a lot of factors here which make it very hard to actually give an apples for apples comparison. But I think, you know, again, the secret to it is to look at the tools that are available, use them effectively. Some of that will typically remain on-prem, so large files which may be limited because of your bandwidth constraints, but things like the backup, things like SharePoint for certain documents, you know, data loss prevention, the enhanced security that Microsoft's also recently announced in its Office 365 product, I think that's some of the key points to take away. And the focus is that, again, what makes the most sense for the customer? What's the best option to solve their problems? And again, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And that's the good thing about Azure is there are plenty of options that you can implement and use. So you can, for example, use RDS in a VM if you wanted to, so remote desktop in a VM. But you could also use remote apps. So there are plenty of options. It just depends options, what makes sense, and understanding those options is going to make life much easier, I think.
Quick question for you. I know we're getting to the end. So that same conversation about to tape, we then talked about another conversation about, say, the place where I used to work, the company where I used to work was all Office 365. They had no servers on-prem. Nothing. They're basically using Office 365 to its fullest extent for the email, SharePoint document libraries, Skype for Business, for communication, and all that sort of stuff, right? So it's a fully cloud-driven business only. All they were like eating their own dog food or drinking their own champagne, whichever you want to put it. And one of the people said to me the other day, said, how do they get away with like retention of data? Because if they're a publicly listed company, they've got to dot their I's and cross their T's, which means they've got to keep stuff for a period of up to, say, 7 years, documents and stuff. Now, I can understand the Exchange Online part, which is the compliance part of it. But, Rob, just quickly, Office 365 as a whole, like including SharePoint and everything else, how does it adopt to this whole seven-year sort of legality part of keeping data?
Well, I think part of it, again, is you need to have those policies which are independent of the IT that you use. And, again, things like Exchange Online have retention policies. They have archiving ability. The same thing applies basically with SharePoint as well. Okay, and it's just okay. Basically good management. And right. It's like having an on-premises file server. But a lot of cases, again, you also have the ability to do third-party backups. So you may decide that, okay, so a good thing, for example, what SharePoint can do, SharePoint can also do automated document lifecycle management. So you can say, this document is valid for 6 months. After a period of 6 months, then move it to this directory, which is an archive. After right. that, you know, 7 year period, then delete the document. So the good thing about something like SharePoint is that it always has come from that sort of background. But if you want a third party independent off separate from Office 365, you can do that. Again, it just comes down to, I think the fact is the legality is, you know, you've got to be able to say, what's your retention policy? How do you deal with documents? Mm-hmm. And again, it does alleviate a lot of the ability to have to do backups constantly. But if you do need to do it for compliance, one of the big things about Office 365, obviously, is it's very strong on its compliance and the facilities are there. It's just a matter of enabling them, turning them on and adapting them to use, you know, to work for your business. So they certainly are there, especially in the enterprise plans. It's just a matter of enabling them and obviously setting up the policies to do what needs to be done when it comes to managing the information.
Okay, cool. Thank you for that. That's about it for me, I think.
I think it's probably enough for us. I think that, like I said, we've probably gone through a lot of information for people here. I hope they've all got value from it. So what's the best way for people to get in contact with you if they do have further questions, queries about anything we've discussed?
Twitter or my blog site. So it's Twitter is at Mark Keane, MarkKean, and my blog site is easy too. It's markkean.com.
All right, so you can find me on the Twitter at DirectorCIA, and my blog is blog.ciaops, where, again, you get lots of regular information on Azure and Office 365, and hopefully break it down and make it easy for people to get started with those individual items and, like I said, start building up the knowledge to be able to deploy solutions for customers. But I think with that, we will call an end to this episode of the Need to Know podcast from CIOps. Thank you very much for listening.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact. This podcast is voiced and produced by me, Mark Keane.